episode 10. Welcome to episode 10 of the Thinking Habits podcast. We're recording this a little early, Pam and I, because we're fortunate enough to be going on holiday this weekend to Berlin for my birthday, so that'll be splendid. But in the meantime, we're recording on a swelteringly hot day. We've had about one teaspoon of rain in the last 2.5 weeks, and it's getting a little bit ugh at the moment, so apologies if we're a bit more lethargic than normal. Before we get into episode 10, I'm going to start doing a bit of a corrections corner, corrections area at the beginning of each podcast. One thing I've been pulled up on, and rightly so, is that when I'm talking about technical stuff, nursey stuff, I will go into abbreviations, I'll go into specific industry lingo and stuff like that that may not be familiar to everybody. So a couple of glossary items from the last episode with Katie. I was talking about flight of thought, or it came up in flight of ideas, came up in conversation. Flight of ideas, if you're not familiar with it, is also known as racing thoughts, and it's when you observe somebody going rapidly from one topic to another, not even finishing the conversation, bouncing from one thing to the next. It's very common in people in the manic phase of bipolar disorder and in acute ADHD symptoms as well, and in other mental health conditions as well. I sometimes experience flight of ideas and racing thoughts when I'm particularly anxious and I'm all over the place. Another one was titration. Some people may not be familiar with that. That simply means, when talking about medication, gradually increasing the dose. And the other one was PRN, which I just take for granted. PRN means as required. So if you were taking an inhaler, for example, a blue inhaler, you'd take it as required. It would say 2 puffs PRN. For the grammar nerds out there, the thing I love is that it's from the Latin pro renata, which means as required. I don't know why they don't just say that, but it's fancy. So those are the three glossary items, which concludes our first corrections corner. I would imagine that would be the first of many, to be honest. In the meantime, say hello, Pam.
Hello.
We're going to be talking about, well, a number of things, really. We're going to be talking about the heat, actually. It's quite relevant because the MS Society posted a Facebook post about people with MS coping with the heat, because Pam, I'm sure you'll be able to elucidate better than me, it can be a real pain for you.
Yes, yeah, it's not just the heat, it's actually worse today because it's muggy, it feels like it needs a storm, and I don't know how much of that is sort of psychological because it's a bit grey and dreary but still really hot and you just feel like you're walking through soup, and how much of it is just that you feel better when the sun's out, but it definitely does make a difference. And yes, they've released a fact sheet on people with MS can find hot weather makes their ongoing symptoms worse, so balance problems and muscle weakness, vision problems and fatigue. And I think everyone suffers more with fatigue, especially in this kind of weather, but it's just exacerbated if it's something that you have a problem with anyway.
I've noticed in the last few days and weeks, while it's been really hot, you've been extra fatigued.
Yes, yeah. And that in itself is exhausting because everything takes extra planning. And, you've got to plan in little rest breaks and what you're doing and what would normally be a straight through day. You've got to plan in, I'll just have a little sit down and a cold drink and make sure I've got enough ice cubes and there's enough stuff in the fridge, and it's just little things like that.
And the amount of things you can do in between breaks is reduced.
Which, staying on topic, kind of spawns its own anxiety that are you going to have enough time to get everything done whilst fitting in rest breaks so that you'll be able to do it?
Yeah.
Whatever it is. So, like, in my case, it would be whatever work I was doing, can I fit in enough breaks to be able to do it?
Yeah.
And it, yeah, that spawns its own anxiety, and then feelings of disappointment if you don't manage to get everything done.
Yeah. You can be quite hard on yourself, can't you? Not you generally, but one.
Yeah, and I think it's quite easy to do. And I think, like I say, I think everyone does suffer a bit with the heat, especially when it's... it really feels, at the moment, this is Monday in Manchester. It feels like it really needs the storm.
Yeah.
And I think that would make everything better. But given that we've had heat warnings for the rest of the week...
Yeah, there's no rain forecast for
it's probably
for
not
a while,
going to happen. So you just have to learn to live with it.
So what advice do the MS Society give? I mean, from what I read, it seems quite obvious, but it's not always something that you would necessarily do.
Like, I mean, drink cold liquids. Most of these, you would say, well, obviously, but it's nice that it's kind of all put together and pointed out. So drink cold liquids or suck ice cubes. Mm-hmm. Open a window or sit in front of a fan. Neither of which we can do right now because it's too noisy.
Yeah. The ice cream van's outside, so it's making a racket.
Take cool baths.
No, thank you.
Cool. It says start with warm water and let the water cool down gradually. I did that other day and it did help a lot.
I don't mind a cold shower, actually. I'd take that. But
ooh, no.
See, a cold shower. I prefer a cold shower to a cold bath.
Yeah. Not a cold bath. That's ridiculous. Avoid direct sunlight.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, and keep your head covered if you're in the sun.
So basically, become a vampire is what it says. A vampire that likes cold drinks.
That eats ice cubes.
Right. Fair enough.
So that's. I mean, let's say none of it's particularly groundbreaking information or anything, but it's nice to have it all put together in one place and makes you a little bit more conscious of it, I think, and makes things a little bit easier to deal with.
It's a cruel irony, really, that anecdotally MS is far less common in hotter countries.
Yeah.
The further away from the equator you get, the more common MS is.
Yes.
They think there might be a link to vitamin D deficiency there, don't they?
Yes.
Possibly.
There's a definite correlation, and I think it's part of the ongoing research as to whether that is an actual cause.
Yeah.
I think the current thinking is that it's most likely one of a number of factors. But it'd be interesting to know.
Yeah.
But it's like I say, I definitely feel better when the sun's out. But I think most people do.
Yeah.
But then, the sun's not out at the moment. It's just really hot.
It's just grim, yeah. I certainly do. Vitamin D certainly helps me. I've never been diagnosed with SAD, but I certainly do get in a right funk in the winter. The lack of daylight in the winter just bums me out completely. And whether or not that's psychosomatic or whether it is in any kind of disorder, I definitely think there's some kind of correlation with vitamin D and mood, definitely.
And
what we were going to move on to today, not just talking about the heat, was also one thing we didn't talk about when you first started talking about your MS and mood and anxiety and such is how you manage pain. Because your pain management is very much sort of intrinsically linked to your mood, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, being in pain is in itself exhausting and depressing. You know, if you're in a lot of pain, you can't think about anything else and it's just miserable.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different pain management. Although I suppose it is quite relevant because recently, those pain management routines that I'd got into haven't been working as well.
Yeah.
That's
quite common for MS, isn't it?
For
the regime to change.
It's always going to need tweaking. But it's, I mean, I tend to deal have a it, manage it as best I can with it's a combination of medications and so yoga does help a lot, and I've got also a TENS machine. I first used a TENS machine about 20 odd years ago for pain that was a problem that I had with my knee, and I didn't know what it was called at the time, and it was used on me in a hospital at a physio class, and then I was reading about different pain management. It might even have been on the MS Society website that I read about, because nerve pain it doesn't have a direct cause. Neuropathic pain, it's basically the in basic terms, the signal to your brain has gone wrong, and you're getting pain in the nerve endings.
We should just pause there so I can preempt a further corrections corner next week. Just to clarify what a TENS machine is for people who don't know.
Yes.
Cue 1950s infomercial music, but a TENS machine is a transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation device, which is a small battery-operated device that has leads connected to sticky pads called electrodes. Those electrodes are then attached to a point on the body near where the pain is. So for your legs, you tend to put them on your upper thigh, don't you?
Or lower back.
Or lower back, yeah.
Yeah.
Then the pulse is sent through the pads in that.
Yeah.
People use them in childbirth and stuff, don't
cause
they?
Yeah, because I think it sort of disrupts the pain signal. It's quite... Because it makes the skin around the electrode feels quite numb, but that makes sense if it's disrupting...
Yeah,
pain signals. It's going to be disrupting all the sensory stuff. I mean, you can wear it for hours at a time. So it's not like the same way, you know, painkillers wear off. You know, sometimes if you have migraines, or you know, if you have a bad any kind of pain, you can a paracetamol or Cocodamol, whatever, you can only take every 4 hours or every 6 hours, and you will have a dip where that's wearing off, but you can't take any more yet. Whereas with a TENS machine, you can just keep using it. It doesn't always work, and sometimes it will aggravate, and it's something I've experienced. It will aggravate to the point of making me feel sick, but more often than not, it helps.
Yeah, we were talking to our friend Claire, who is I mentioned on I think the first episode or the second episode. She's the lady who was stranded in the desert in California for 4 days after breaking her pelvis. She's currently back in Canada, and she's making tremendous progress on her long road to recovery. But we were talking to her about nerve pain, and she's bought a TENS machine, having mixed results with it, but some relief in the sense that it's taking her mind off it to a certain extent. But I mean, given the extent of her injuries, I think anything is a boon at this stage. So we'll take a quick moment to say hi to Claire and wish her the very best, because she's doing a tremendous job. And we also spoke to Kelly yesterday, didn't we? Our friend Kelly has EDS. Which, while you explain what she was doing with the TENS machine, I'm going to look at what EDS is.
So when she was here, she was having nerve pain in her arm, and I asked if she'd ever used a TENS machine, and she hadn't heard of it. So I said, "Well, you can have a quick go on mine if you like." And it did give some relief. She was able to put it onto her shoulder, because it was her arm that was affected, and it did give some. Brief relief.
Back to the infomercial music. EDS stands for Ehlers-Danlos Syndromes, and it is a group of rare inherited conditions that affect connective tissue. There are several different types of EDS, which cause an increased range of joint movement, stretchy skin, fragile skin that breaks or bruises easily. But the connective tissue weakening causes pain, and during hypermobility. It also causes extreme tiredness and fatigue. There's quite a few symptoms, actually, that are very similar to MS.
Yeah.
In the sense that there's extreme tiredness with fatigue, joint pain, dizziness and increased heart rate, problems with internal organs, problems with bladder and bowel control in certain cases. There are some very similar sort of connections between the two.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of sort of shared symptoms between a lot of different chronic and autoimmune diseases. And I mean, I think the fatigue, as much as anything, can come from the fact that being in pain is tiring.
Yeah, it is.
And I think that the fatigue is almost a symptom of that. Rather, it's the effect from being in pain all the time, or from things taking extra effort. If you've got that, like the muscle weakness, will. You're obviously going to get more tired doing normal tasks. I mean, I quite recently completed a course of physiotherapy it's neurophysiotherapy, so aimed at people with neurological disease or neurological injuries.
Yeah.
So I think that, like, stroke recovery, things like that, but also chronic conditions such as MS, and that's that teaching you how to compensate for problems that you may have, or exercises to build up joint strength, and where you can compensate for problems that you can't overcome. So if there's some movement that's not going to come back, how you can manage that and how you can do it elsewhere. I mean, the strangest thing we did was learn how to fall over.
Oh, right.
Or learn how to fall but not fall over.
Right.
So it was like writing yourself in a safe space.
Oh, cool.
So if you lose your balance, how to stumble and without falling over.
Yeah.
Basically. So it was a bit of an odd one.
Yeah.
That's been really useful. And kind of fits quite nicely into the yoga that I've been doing, which will also hopefully, have the same results, that if I can build up muscle strength to compensate for nerve damage, then that should stand me in good stead.
Mm. I remember your MS nurse saying, the stronger you can get while you are healthy won't necessarily prevent a relapse, but it will mitigate the effects of any relapse that would have on your physical strength during and after.
It should minimize long-term effects from it. I mean, it's not something you can plan for, but it should mitigate long-term damage.
Yeah. And we talk about I think I've vaguely touched on it in an earlier episode, but we talk about energy with chronic conditions in terms of spoons.
Yes.
I don't know if anybody listening has heard of that spoon theory, but the spoon theory is a disability metaphor and neologism used to explain the reduced amount of energy available for activities of daily living and any productive tasks that may result from a disability or chronic illness. A person who runs out of spoons has no choice but to rest until their spoons are replenished. So, for example, you're the best person to give the example. I can read from Wikipedia, but it's first-hand knowledge more.
Yeah, it's saying that your daily routine will cost you a number of spoons. So any plans you make have to factor in what you would normally have to do. And getting up, having a shower, having something to eat, getting dressed. So that all has to be factored in, whereas it used to be second nature. You have to, when you're making plans, you have to make sure that you are going to have... that is an extreme example to say at that level. That's an extreme example to say you'd have to factor in your normal routine. But
some people do.
Yeah. So yeah.
And when you've been really poorly.
Yes, and I have been in that. Thankfully, it's not something that is all the time, but it is certainly something that I have experienced, and it's you know, there have been days where it's kind of like, well, I can get up and get ready, or I can bring my laptop in here and sit in bed and do some work.
Yeah.
I can't get up and get ready and do work.
Yeah.
It's one or the other.
So if you think of spoons as an expendable unit of energy.
Yeah.
Of which you only have a finite amount during the day.
Yes.
Then if you say you've got 20 spoons in the day, 5 of those may be taken up by getting dressed. So on a bad day. So that makes a huge difference to your day and your planning, like you said, and the heat, I mean, to use a clumsy metaphor, melts some of your spoons,
yes,
doesn't it, really?
It's quite a good metaphor, I'd say. It certainly does, and it's it just adds that extra layer of planning into any kind, you know, that extra layer of planning requirement into any plans that we make, or that I make with anyone else, and you know, factoring in like, will I have spots to sit and take a rest?
Yeah.
Like planning going around Berlin, we'll be able to stop for drinks.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a Teutonic planner, so I've got list upon list upon list of places we're going to go. And obviously with it being so hot, we're both going to want to stop for breaks, but we do have to factor that in more regularly, more diligently, really.
Yeah.
I mean, a good example is we co-own a brewery with two friends, Erin and Lauren, and it's only a tiny one, but we've been fortunate enough to be involved in Manchester Beer Week in the last couple of weeks, and Pam was doing the open brew day on that day, which is it's a very manually intensive task, brewing, you know, brewing with a 6-barrel kit. It's hundreds of kilos of heavy lifting and stirring and digging and all this kind of stuff. And Pam was preparing for this one particular Tuesday for days and days and days, because she knew that she needed to save up as much energy as possible to be able to do that as well as she wanted to, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, but you knew you'd be wiped out on the Wednesday, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, thankfully I was the only girl there for part of it, so I just pulled the girly card and went, I'm not lifting that. But you know, I did do my fair share, and we brewed on the small kit as well.
Yeah.
So I was sort of supervising that.
Yeah.
With Erin when she came in the afternoon. Yeah, it was a long day, and then I stayed to watch the football afterwards.
Hmm.
But I already knew that the Wednesday was going to be a low key day, but then there was more planning to do
for the rest of the week.
Yeah.
But that just sort of illustrates how that kind of planning has become sort of intrinsic into your daily life now. It's almost second nature, but it still blindsides you occasionally.
Yeah, it does, and. You know, and it's taken, I've been caught out to quite a few, you know, I have been caught out before where I've just booked stuff in and, or not, you know, just got on with it and not noticed until it became a proper crash.
Mm.
And end up getting ill, or, you know, some other kind of, or getting migraines is often my thing when I've been overdoing it, but I've got much better at when I'm planning my time, not just that day, but how much have I got going on the days around it.
I mean, going back to the conversation we were having with Kelly about her EDS and how she manages her spoons, they're very good at managing their diaries, aren't they?
Yes.
About factoring in days where they consciously don't do anything.
Yeah.
And actively doing nothing can be quite... It can be absolutely important, but it can also be quite tiring as well, in a weird way.
Yeah, I think it's because sometimes when you let yourself stop and just do nothing, it's like then it carries on. I think sometimes when you do stop, you don't realise how tired you are.
Yeah.
And then it catches up with you. Mm. It's like if you watch someone who's been drinking shots, and you look at them and think, that's not going to end well.
No.
And they go, no, no, I'm fine. And then over the next half hour or so, even though they've stopped drinking, they're just steadily becoming more and more drunk until they end up in a mess.
First 2 days of any week off, you have a cold.
Yeah, yeah. It's all part of it. It's like your body takes time to catch up, and then so when you do stop, you have this kind of extra dip where your body kind of goes, oh, now I can relax, and your mind relaxes, and
because you're often running on adrenaline, aren't you?
Yeah, running on fumes, as they say.
Yeah, and I think we've got slightly better, well, a lot better actually, to about filling up rather than getting down to running on fumes.
Yeah, but that's only through experience. You know, it's and I think it's. It's something that was resisted by both of us in different ways.
Not so much resisted, more sort of actively disregarded, I think. Mm. But I think what was weird, what's often weird, it's the age old tale, isn't it? I noticed it in you, you noticed it in me, but we couldn't notice it in each other until it was pointed out.
Yes, yeah.
So... Now that that's been acknowledged, we're far more open to that kind of sort of self-analysis. But yeah, I think that it comes with a sort of change in mindset, doesn't it? You're a long time dead, but so you've got to look after yourself.
Yeah, but I think doing this podcast as well, because it's you know, talking about things that might sort of have as a fleeting thought, but you're put it away for now, and I'll come back to that later, and then just not. I think it certainly makes me more conscious about how I'm feeling and how that's affecting my mood, and how it affects anxiety, certainly, and something I get really, really badly in this kind of weather is, and it's a term that people with MS and possibly other conditions, I don't know as much about them, but use the term brain fog.
Yeah.
And it is just like your brain's gone all foggy.
Yeah.
And I can't even finish a sentence. It's
I think that's just because you're thinking about it, but I do notice it, yeah.
And it just like everything slows down, or I'll be thinking about like I must do that next, and then I'll be thinking, right, mustn't forget, right, I'll be finishing a task thinking, right, I'm going to do that, and then a split second later, completely gone. And then it'll be half an hour later, I never did that thing.
And I notice that you get a little bit more forgetful when it's very hot, and you get very tired.
Yes.
And not so much pain wise. It doesn't seem to affect the heat doesn't directly affect your pain, I don't think.
No, it doesn't as much. Muscle fatigue is quite painful. That's painful in and of itself. But
yeah, sorry,
no,
I don't get the
nerve pain, so like the pins and needles type feelings and stuff. I don't get that as much when the weather's warm, even when it's like muggy and close like this. That's not so much of a problem, but yeah, the muscle fatigue. But again, I don't, you know, it's a good job I've got an appointment coming up, because you know, I take medication for fatigue, and I'm not sure how much good that's doing me. I mean, I've been on it 4 years, and I've done really well with it. But the past
couple of months, I'm not so sure it's as effective anymore. No. So that's something else for me to talk about. And something else to think about and ruminate on and get anxious about.
Yeah. But at the same time, I can play devil's advocate here and put your mind at rest that the consultant will have heard it, you know, heard similar cases from other people before, so they'll have other options.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And they'll have other things they'll be able to talk to you about and help you with, but that doesn't stop you from having a little disco freak out, and I understand that because I have, you know, I have similar disco freak outs, about far less. So, but yeah, your neuro appointment will help with that because you'll be able to get all that out.
Yeah.
So do you want to explain a little bit more about what the sort of pins and needles feels like, how it manifests?
So it's very much like when I get nerve pain in my legs, which is the most common that I get, and it's more common at night, and that is very, very common apparently with MS. That's the pattern that it follows for a lot of people. The best comparison I can give is if you run for a bus and you've not warmed up, or you push yourself too hard when you're exercising and then get the lactic acid burn. It's like that, but just from nowhere and constant. Stretching doesn't help, tensing, curling up, relaxing, nothing helps. And there's specific painkillers that treat the nerve pain. Gabapentin is one.
Pregabalin
is apparently not as effective against sort of muscle spasms. So it treats the pain, but it's not as good at treating the spasm. So that's why gabapentin's the first choice. And then if that's not working for you, you can try pregabalin.
Gabapentin, in fact, fans, was initially developed as a drug for phantom limb pain.
Oh, right. Mm. I think it's a... was it prescribed for epilepsy as well?
It was.
I don't know.
It's now a controlled drug because of its widespread misuse.
Yes.
Because of its sedative in overdose, and also anecdotally, when I used to work in the prison, people used to cheek their tablets, so hide them up in their gums, and then take them back to the cell, open them up, and snort them. And apparently, that gives quite a sense of euphoria, and they can also be addictive. Well, they are also addictive. But what's really interesting with you is that you don't have any of the addictive effects because the meds are being used on the right receptors. So you're actually getting...
I don't get any of the euphoria either.
No.
I've never had any nice floaty feelings.
it just about takes the edge off your nerve pain, doesn't it, really?
Quite often prescribed alongside gabapentin is amitriptyline, which I tried for a while, but it didn't really agree with me, and so instead of that I take duloxetine, which is an antidepressant, but it works well in combination with gabapentin at treating nerve pain.
So amitriptyline is used to treat chronic pain caused by arthritis, spinal problems, fibromyalgia, chronic headaches. It's also used as an antidepressant. It may also help, with the with anxiety or depression resulting from the pain, but some doctors do prescribe it as a direct antidepressant, although far less so now. It's a tricyclic antidepressant as opposed to an SSRI, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor like Prozac or citalopram.
And duloxetine is another
tricyclic,
isn't it?
It is, yeah. So, alongside your Copaxone, which we've talked about,
the injection
that smells like salt and vinegar crisps, and you've got your gabapentin, you've got your duloxetine.
Yeah.
You've got your citalopram.
We hadn't mentioned that.
Oh, we hadn't got that far.
No, we hadn't.
Sorry,
mentioned,
jumped
no,
ahead.
There's gabapentin and duloxetine. I only take duloxetine at night.
Mm-hmm.
And there's amantadine for fatigue, although I don't know that, how effective that
amantadine,
still is.
Amantadine, that's an interesting one. Because amantadine is actually a Parkinson's drug.
It's actually an antiviral, but it was given to Parkinson's patients.
Yes. Amantadine, going back to good old Wikipedia, trade name Simitrol by Endo Pharmaceuticals, is a medication that has been approved as both an antiviral and an anti-Parkinsonian medication. Something about amino acids, blah, 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 blah. It was recommended for the treatment of influenza. It is no longer. However, its effectiveness as an anti-Parkinsonian drug was noted anecdotally. But what the reason why they prescribe it for you is because it's anecdotally very good at relieving fatigue.
Yes.
Which it really was. When you first started taking it, I remember there was an absolute sea change in your fatigue levels.
Yes.
It was amazing.
Yeah, oh, yeah, it was amazing. And it was, I didn't actually realise how bad I'd been feeling and how much that had been affecting me until I felt better.
Mm.
It really was like switching a light on.
But it's not really, I don't think it's doing anything anymore.
No. I mean, I think from memory, there's a couple of options. Like some people, they recommend you'd like, stop taking it for a month, but I think it's something you need to come off under supervision.
I don't think you can just
I don't think it's something that I should just do on my own, given that all the information with it says you should keep taking it. Don't stop taking this unless your doctor tells you to. So there's that, and I take citalopram, but that's for anxiety. That's an antidepressant that I actually take as an antidepressant.
As an antidepressant,
I actually take what it was developed for.
So you have quite the cornucopia.
Quite the pharmacy.
Yeah, and that is what you're on now. You were on amitriptyline for a while instead of your duloxetine.
Yes,
weren't you?
Yeah, and I was on a lot more gabapentin.
Yeah,
duloxetine, combining with duloxetine has enabled me to reduce the amount of gabapentin that I take, which is good because it means that there's still capacity to increase again if I need to.
Yeah, it gives you some wiggle room, which is really important.
Which I wouldn't, because I was on almost the maximum dose before I changed.
Mm.
And that wasn't a pleasant thought to think that I could have been on.
You couldn't have gone anywhere with it.
Yeah, because I think you're looking at much more aggressive pain management treatment.
Yeah.
So that I wouldn't really want to go anywhere near just yet.
No, not yet. But I mean, there are places to go.
Yeah.
But it's unusual for a medication regime for a chronic illness to stay completely unchanged for a number of years. There's always some tweaking because your body changes. It's just a body. As you get older, as your diet changes, as your mood changes, as the years change, as other factors change, your medication needs to adjust with it, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that's why you have your annual checkups or 6 monthly checkups or whatever. Sorry, that was my foot. Cracked.
That's another thing. Creaky joints.
Yes.
Yeah. Although you had that before you got diagnosed with MS, so
I
wouldn't worry too much about that.
But
you have a 6 monthly nurse checkup and then a 6 monthly.
I have an annual nurse checkup and an annual consultant checkup.
And they're every 6 months.
But it's supposed to be timed so that they fall every 6 months. Although something has happened. I got put on the wrong list or something.
Oh, it's gone a bit wonky, hasn't
it?
Yeah.
So I've got an appointment in August and then another one in September. So something's gone a bit weird there, so I'll have to ask them about that.
But the most important thing, which is really important about all of this, is that when you're managing a chronic condition, is to talk about it. Pam, you're on a lot of like message boards and and support groups and things like that, aren't you, as well?
Yeah, there's a lot of... there's a couple of different Facebook groups, and some of them are open and some of them are closed and they're quite specific about who can join, which is... It's good because in some way the open boards, when there's... there can be sort of relatives of people with, or there can be people with all different chronic illnesses, and it can turn into quite a lot of noise because there's just a lot of people on there. But there's one that's very specific that I'm a member of, that's which is, it's just women with MS, because they will have, although every case is different, women will have more similar symptoms than say than men. But I mean, I wouldn't have a problem if it was all genders, but I think some people feel it's a safe space if it's women only. But the more important bit is that it's just for people who suffer from MS. It's not for their relatives or their carers, because there's other boards that they can go to. And sometimes it is just people going, oh, I'm having a really bad day. And I think I spoke about this, I mentioned this the last time we
possibly
spoke about it, but yeah, that's quite useful. And also you can people will sometimes ask for advice on medication, like my doctor's recommended this, or has anyone got any experience, or I've been taking, like in my case, I've been taking amantadine for 4 years, I don't think it's working anymore. Has anyone else had this happen to them? What did you do about it? And just getting a bit of advice from people who've been through this similar situations. The same with anything, really, any kind of support group or network. You you can speak to people with who get it. Not, and that's not to say that you don't get it.
No, not at all. But I don't, you know, I can empathise, but you know, I can't experience it. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having a group that's exclusive to just certain people suffering with the condition, to the exclusion of partners and other people, because there are support groups for those people, and sometimes you just need to speak to somebody who is going through the same thing as you.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. And because there are plenty of inclusive groups that allow everybody to talk. There's plenty of inclusive groups that allow carers and partners of to talk about things.
Yeah, and I think the online community is really important, because you can come into contact, and converse with so many more people than you ever would in, even if you were, even if I found all the Manchester MS support groups and joined them all, I wouldn't come into contact with as nearly as many people as I do on this message board.
Yeah.
And I think if, in that respect, you're much more likely to be able to connect with someone who has experienced something similar to you.
And you're more likely to meet... I think also, when you're dealing with a chronic condition where anxiety comes as part of it, they're often less likely to go to a physical meetup.
It
provides a safe space that still preserves a certain level of anonymity, doesn't it?
Yeah, you don't have to talk yourself into going and sitting in a room full of people you don't know, which is my worst nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, unless you've got anything in particular to add, I think we can wind it up there. I think we need another cold beverage, because it's absolutely baking.
Yeah,
need
to put the fan on and open the window.
Open the window again. Well, I hope that's been useful. I know from my point of view, it's always, you know, I've heard it all before, but I still get reminded of things that sometimes I not take for granted, but I'd kind of forget about, you know, working out when you're struggling and you don't necessarily say something. So
yeah, well, I've realised that, you know, I've been, it's not all negative. I'm happy a lot of the time.
Yeah,
I'm happy most of the time.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
It's not all doom and gloom.
No, it's not at all. It's not at all. And I think, you know, I can personally say that I think you're managing incredibly well.
thanks.
And you, and a lot of people are often very surprised to find out that you have got MS, because unless you're very tired, because your mobility suffers, and your eyesight suffers, or you drop things, you wouldn't necessarily know unless you told them.
No.
But that comes with its own problems, because invisible illnesses often mean that you don't get the same recognition or acknowledgement of those illnesses as you would do if you had something that was visible or, you know, tangible.
Yeah, that's right, and I think that's a whole other can of worms.
I think that is definitely a can of worms which I'd open on a slightly cooler day.
Not more for right now.
On that bombshell, we'll wind it up there. And you'll be listening to this on the Sunday. We'll be somewhere in East Germany at that point, on the old East Germany at that point, hopefully having a beer. We'll be thinking of you, obviously. as usual, thank you very much for listening. If you've got any comments or suggestions, the email address is podcast@thinkinghabits.co.uk. The Instagram and Twitter is @thinkinghabits, and the Facebook is facebook.com/thinkinghabitspodcast. Thanks very much. Keep talking, and if you need to talk, you know where we are. Bye.
Bye.